Order, order.
From the House this week, new rules for swimming pools and launching pads for space rockets, and eulogies for trade union leader Helen Kelly and King Bhumibol Adulyadej of Thailand.
Mr. Speaker, King Phnompon was the world's longest-serving monarch, and he made an extraordinary contribution to Thailand and the region during his reign. He presided over a period of transformative growth and development.
The Prime Minister, John Key, who led the tributes on Wednesday with the Greens Foreign Affairs spokesman, Kennedy Graham, recalling the time that he'd met the King.
It was on the occasion of the presentation of the credentials of our ambassador. I was in humble and obedient attendance. We were required to walk into the chamber 3 paces, bow, move to the right 3 paces, bow, then move forward to meet His Majesty. The challenge, to put it mildly, was that we were required to walk backwards on withdrawing, since it is not permitted to turn one's back on the King. And we so nearly got it right.
On Tuesday, tributes to Helen Kelly, trade union leader and former president of the Council of Trade Unions, were led by opposition leader Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, Helen Kelly did not see herself as a hero. She was a champion, an advocate, an agitator. She epitomised the best of New Zealand values. When she saw others in need, she offered to help. When she saw injustice, she strove to correct it. When she saw the opportunity to fight for progressive ideals, she climbed in, boots and all, uncompromisingly, relentlessly, and with one goal: to make positive change.
Andrew Little's tribute to Helen Kelly was followed by one from the Prime Minister.
Speaker, Helen Kelly didn't come from my side of the political fence. There were, on many occasions, that I simply didn't agree with her, not the least of being, actually, her disagreement with the government's view that the law should be changed in relation to the definition of a contractor, so movies like The Hobbits could be made in New Zealand. Mr. Speaker, sometimes the forceful way that Helen Kelly made her arguments frustrated me. But she also had my enormous respect. She was passionate, she was tenacious, she was articulate, she was intelligent, and she was pragmatic.
Joining Nationals leader and mourning the death of Helen Kelly was the New Zealand First Party's Winston Peters.
Those New Zealanders who've had the opportunity to witness the work and life of Helen Kelly over a great number of years would celebrate the fact that she was a standout New Zealander, a person of true character, of honesty and integrity. Clearly, she put her cause and the people she served before herself, and in doing so enhanced the respect for the union movement in this country, and indeed it could be said to have, in her interactions, put unionism on a new level. We were a better country for witnessing her professional life, and a lesser country for her departure.
New Zealand First Party leader Winston Peters, who, as Rhys Lyon now reports, proceeded to open up entirely new horizons in the art of self-promotion in the debating chamber the next day.
Wednesday was a members' day where opposition MPs and government backbenchers get the chance to debate bills in their names. The Land Transfer Foreign Ownership of Land Register Amendment Bill, in the name of the New Zealand First Leader, is sitting at number 7 on the members' order paper, far enough down that it was never going to come up for debate on Wednesday night. And with only 2 members' days likely remaining in 2016, it may not get to be debated by the end of the year. Mr. Peters' New Zealand First colleagues, though, used provisions allowing for questions to members in charge of bills to put a series of questions to their party leader at the end of question time on Wednesday.
My question is to the member responsible for the Land Transfer Foreign Ownership of Land Register Amendment Bill.
To the member responsible for the Land Transfer Foreign Ownership.
My question is to the member responsible for the Land Transfer.
To the member responsible for the Land Transfer.
We move now to the final question to the member. Question number 6, Richard Prosser.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Before answering the questions from his party colleagues, Mr. Peters sought to judge their quality.
Very insightful question.
The Honourable...
That's an excellent question. Very good.
Somewhere in there, Mr. Peters did outline the intent of the bill.
Mr. Speaker, there is currently, under this administration, no easy or accurate way to measure the amount of land under the control of foreign nationals. This is due to the fact that, unlike in other jurisdictions, there is no official database of foreign ownership in New Zealand. And that's what this bill is going to fix up.
New Zealand First leader Winston Peters. Later on Wednesday, a bill seeking to abolish charter or partnership schools in the name of Labour MP Chris Hipkins came up for its first reading just after 9 p.m. With Mr. Hipkins not available to introduce the Education Charter Schools Abolition Amendment Bill, that job fell to his Labour colleague, Jenny Salesa, who began with an explanation as to Mr. Hipkins' absence.
And I'd like to acknowledge and congratulate Mr. Chris Hipkins and Jade for the birth of their new baby earlier on this evening, as well as all the work that he has put in to this bill. Charter schools, Mr. Speaker, are a blight on our educational system. They bring nothing to the table that cannot be offered through our existing education system. I welcome this bill, which would abolish the charter school model.
And while that debate was interrupted when MPs adjourned for the night at 10 p.m. on Wednesday, earlier in the evening, a bill in the name of National's Chris Bishop, the Financial Assistance for Live Organ Donors Bill, passed its second reading unopposed. Earlier, the Papua and Kaiko Kirikiri Trusts Amendment Bill, a private bill in the name of National's Alistair Scott, completed its committee stage.
Rhys Lyon will be back later in the program with news from the committee rooms, while debate on government bills began on Tuesday with this from the Minister for Science and Innovation, Stephen Joyce.
Mr. Speaker, I move that the Outer Space and High Altitude Activities Bill be now read a first time.
Mr. Joyce explained why the government was keen on space exploration.
The emerging New Zealand space industry aligns with the innovation stream of the government's business growth agenda, in developing New Zealand as a hub for high-value research and development intensive businesses. Mr. Speaker, we've never had so many opportunities to create and sell high-quality products and services around the world.
After seeing his bill off to the Foreign Affairs, Defence and Trade Committee, which will be taking submissions on it up until Thursday, December the 1st, Mr. Joyce was back in the chamber on Thursday to answer a question from one of his own backbenchers addressed to the Finance Minister, asking Mr. English if he'd seen any reports about the diversification of the New Zealand economy.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister of Finance, I've seen a number of reports, including as recently as last night when the Technology Investment Network report was launched by the Minister of Science and Innovation.
Stephen Joyce.
The report shows New Zealand's leading 200 high-tech companies have now reached combined annual revenues of $9.4 billion, up 12%, or nearly $1 billion in just 1 year.
Very good.
The Minister for Science and Innovation, Stephen Joyce, answering questions about a report from his own ministry on behalf of Finance Minister Bill English, who also faced this question on Thursday from Winston Peters.
What justification or excuse does he have to cancel a meeting scheduled with two prominent Hong Kong pro-democracy figures this week?
That question was answered for Mr. English by his immediate junior, the third-ranked Cabinet Minister, Gerry Brownlee.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Deputy Prime Minister, ministers from time to time, after considering advice, will decide not to progress previously scheduled meetings.
Mr. Brownlee continued to stonewall, even after the New Zealand First Party leader pointed out that the two pro-democracy leaders had been invited to meet the American Vice President, Joe Biden, and Australia's Foreign Minister, Julie Bishop.
Why weren't national ministers prepared to meet with them?
The Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Deputy Prime Minister, I have no responsibility for the diaries of other foreign ministers.
Well, that's a slack answer. Supplementary question.
Order. Order.
Just and, dreadful.
And the member's perfectly entitled to that opinion, but he doesn't need to share it with
fair
the
enough.
House.
That's a fair enough figure.
The Speaker, David Carter, made no attempt to hide his opinion of the answer that the Minister of Health, Jonathan Coleman, gave to a question from his Labour shadow, Annette King.
Of course, there will always be a debate about what the right level of resourcing is. Otherwise, there wouldn't be anything for Mrs. King to do in Parliament. However, I'm
order.
Well acquainted with that member's
order.
Gloomy...
and
order. Point of order, Mr. Speaker. Well, that's not necessary, isn't it?
No, it's certainly not necessary. It's an answer that doesn't help the order of the House. But in itself, order in itself, it's not unparliamentary. There are no rules I can deal with. I'll deal with it another way.
Mr Carter didn't elaborate on that, but it wasn't long before he was asked to discipline Mr Coleman again, this time for his answer to this question from Labour's Sue Moroney.
Well, is there a link then between more than 1,000 resident doctors reporting being so fatigued they were worried about that clinical mistakes had been made and this massive increase in treatment injuries under his watch?
The Honourable Dr Jonathan Coleman.
No more so than there's a link between the record majorities that members enjoy in every seat that Sue Moroney stands in.
Order. That doesn't even attempt to address the question. Would the Minister now address the question?
Well, I said no.
Order. The public of New Zealand will judge the Minister's answer for themselves.
Further along, the government's front bench ACT MP, David Seymour, was too quick off the mark for one of Mr Carter's assistant speakers, Trevor Mallard.
The question is that the motion be agreed to. Well, Mr Seymour, you might like to wait until you've been called.
Well, thank you, Mr Speaker.
Well, Mr Seymour, you have been giving your views quite long and loud. I didn't intervene, but I think you could follow the formalities of the House and seek a call.
Mr Speaker.
David Seymour.
Thank you, Mr Speaker.
Thank you, Mr Seymour. And now it's back to Rhys Lyon and the committee rooms.
On Wednesday, medical experts briefed the Health Committee on progress in monitoring and treating prostate cancer. The chairman of the Prostate Cancer Working Group, Professor John Nacy, told committee members about the group's development of a guidance program for specialists on active guidance.
The importance of this is that for prostate cancer, there has been a lot of criticism of men being tested because if they are found to have prostate cancer, then invariably they will end up having what we describe as a curative treatment. So it's either radiation therapy or maybe they'll have their prostate removed surgically. The problem with this is that there is always the potential for adverse effects, and therefore men have a major impact on their quality of life. So active surveillance is designed to manage men with early prostate cancer that is not aggressive and is highly unlikely to cause any injury to them in their remaining lifespan. So basically, it is a program put in place to monitor them, just to make sure that their known cancer is not progressing.
Chairman of the Prostate Cancer Working Group, Professor John Nacy, with that briefing to the Health Committee on Wednesday. The following day, the Primary Production Committee heard submissions on the Food Safety Reform Bill, including one from the Soil and Health Association, whose policy advisor, Misha Davis, called for mandatory country of origin labelling on food.
And we are disappointed that MPI and successive governments have continually blocked mandatory country of origin labelling. Country of origin labelling can be very important for a country's reputation. For example, we know that employment conditions vary between countries and support for different countries can play into people's food purchasing decisions.
Ms Davis also called for more detailed labelling on food products.
We consider that genetic engineering, pesticide residues, and food irradiation are all food safety issues worthy of being addressed through transparent food labelling laws and regulations in New Zealand. Transparent food labelling is fundamental in allowing people to make informed choices about which foods are safe and nutritious.
That point was picked up by Mr Davis's Soil and Health Association colleague, Dr Alison White.
Consumers, and especially parents, tend to make precautionary decisions. So if a thing looks as if it might be unsafe, then the consumers and especially parents will tend to err on the side of precaution and avoid that.
Dr. White said that was a much different approach than that taken by food authorities.
For various reasons, regulatory authorities tend to follow the reactionary principle. In other words, show us the dead bodies lined up and then we'll do something about it.
Soil and Health's Dr. Alison White with that submission on the Food Safety Reform Bill, which is due to be reported back from the Primary Production Committee by February the 16th next year. In total, there were 18 committee meetings held during the week.
That report from Rhys Lyon. Back in the debating chamber on Thursday, the House passed two bills and agreed with the appointment of a new electoral officer and new deputy chairwoman of the Electoral Commission, after a short debate launched by the Minister of Justice, Amy Adams.
I move that pursuant to Section 4D of the Electoral Act 1993 and Section 32 of the Crown Entities Act 2004, this House recommends Her Excellency the Governor-General appoints Ms. Christy Pearl MacDonald QC as Deputy Chair of the Electoral Commission and Ms. Alicia Wright as Chief Electoral Officer, both for a term of 5 years. Mr. Speaker, the Electoral Commission plays a central role in New Zealand's constitution and democracy. It ensures parliamentary elections, by-elections and referenda are held so New Zealanders can effectively participate in their democracy, choosing their elected representatives and expressing their views on important issues. It manages the Māori electoral option, allowing those of Māori descent to choose which electoral role they want to be on, and oversees the enrolment of electors for parliamentary and local elections. It also supports the Representation Commission in setting boundaries for general and Māori electorates after each census and provides advice and public education on electoral matters. Given the significance of the Commission, Parliament has decided that its three board members, the Chair, the Deputy Chair and the Chief Electoral Officer, are appointed by the Governor-General on the recommendation of the House of Representatives. Both the Chair and the Deputy Chair serve in part-time roles, while the Chief Electoral Officer, who is also the Board's Chief Executive, works full-time. The people appointed to these important positions need to have strong experience in governance and knowledge of the public sector. They need good strategic planning skills and unquestionable personal integrity and independence. The Chief Electoral Officer, as the Chief Executive of the Commission, also needs to be a strong manager of people and to hold expertise in financial and risk management. The appointee needs to have a sound understanding of the electoral process and a track record of demonstrating a clear commitment to neutrality and delivery in a complex political environment. The term of the current Chief Electoral Officer, Robert Peddin, expired in August 2015. Mr. Peddin kindly agreed to continue to serve as the Chief Electoral Officer while awaiting the outcome of the appointment process. Additionally, a new Deputy Chair needs to be appointed after Jane Huria also advised that she was not available for reappointment and resigned with effect from 30 September this year. I particularly want to thank Mr. Peddin and Ms. Huria for their public service to the Electoral Commission and to New Zealand. Their dedication to the roles and to the Electoral Commission have been greatly appreciated. Their work was of a very high standard and was carried out with the utmost integrity. The Electoral Commission, Mr. Speaker, is undoubtedly the cornerstone of ensuring our elections run smoothly and fairly.
Justice Minister Amy Adams and the House agreed to those two appointments without dissent. Then the interrupted debate on the third reading of the Swimming Pools Amendment Bill resumed on Thursday afternoon with this contribution from Labor's member for Manukau East, Jenny Saleza.
One of the main reasons why we do not support the current bill is the fact that it is proposed that alarms are adequate instead of having a door or a fence to ensure that our kids do not drown. The Fencing and Swimming Pools Act of 1987, it was designed for the safety of our young children, and we believe that having a fence or a physical door is the right way to go, Mr. Speaker. Labor does not support this bill. Thank you very much.
Jenny Saleza was followed by the National Member for Invercargill, Sarah Dowie.
This is a bill to maintain the protections to prevent drowning and injuries of young people when around swimming pools and the like. Of course, this looks to repeal the Fencing of Swimming Pools Act and bring or simplify or codify the rules surrounding the fencing of pools into the Building Act. And the reason for doing that is to make it more simple for people to understand the regulations and to make sure that they comply.
And Sarah Dowie was followed by Green List MP Eugenie Sage.
The Green Party opposes the Building Pools Amendment Bill, and the Minister in his speech at the start of the third reading claimed that the main deficiency in the law around swimming pools was compliance, and he claimed that this bill would fix that by the requirement to inspect every 3 years. That's more myth-making by Nick Smith. It is not law changes which promote compliance, but resources which agencies put into actually undertaking the compliance and then following up when they find that the law hasn't been complied with. And it was the fact that 30 of some 67 councils have no periodic inspections was probably down to limited resources that those councils had rather than a defect in the law. It was spin by the Minister to disguise the fact that the bill is removing the clear focus that the Fencing of Swimming Pools Act, the existing Act, has and has had for the last 30 years on protecting children from drowning and near drowning. And it was spin because we know that the motivation behind this bill, which repeals the Fencing of Swimming Pools Act, has been to save money and to reduce compliance costs for pool owners.
Green List MP Eugenie Sage, whose party joined Labor and the Māori Party, in voting against passing the Building Pools Amendment Bill. Their combined 45 votes defeated by the 73 of National New Zealand First Act and United Future. The government then moved the House on to the third reading of the Education Legislation Bill in the name of Education Minister Hekia Parata.
Mr Speaker, there are a number of elements that are described in this bill and reflect the policy intent we have as a government, which can be succinctly described as parents having choice, schools and early learning providers and tertiary institutions having flexibility such that the provision they offer suits the personalised and diverse needs of our young people, and that those young people are getting real results in real time. And you can see that set of policy imperatives in the provisions within this bill. For example, we are providing for principals to be in charge of more than one school at one time. We are not requiring that occur, we are simply providing an option. And there are circumstances around the country where that option is necessary. Those circumstances are primarily rural and amongst smaller schools. Now, of the 2,500 schools we have across the country, about 40% of those have roles of 100 to 150 or less. That means providing leadership, exemplary leadership of teaching and of schools for our young people in every one of those. And there have been times when that option hasn't been readily available, or it hasn't been as successful as we might have wished, because the particular principal available may not have been, if you like, fit for purpose for that particular community. So the provision in this bill is very much about where these circumstances arrive, there will be an option at law for boards that agree to do so to appoint a principal to more than one school, and clearly where the principal herself or himself wishes to do that. So again, I want to reiterate, it is not in this bill requiring that this occur, but that there be an option. As 21st century living for all of us as parents, some of us as grandparents, have found greater diversity and flexibility in the way we learn, the way we work and so forth, we want to make sure that our education legislation underpins flexibility of choice, where in a community, having the board having consulted with its parent community and anyone else affected, could look to change times. And that may become more desirable as more and more of our schools and early childhood centres form the fabulous communities of learning and work together to make sure that that whole of pathway is organised as efficiently and as effectively as the families in those communities. So we're providing for that.
Education Minister Hekia Parata launching the third reading debate on her education legislation bill, which drew this comment from the Greens' Catherine Delahunty.
Well, I just listened very carefully to the Minister's third reading speech and I tried to understand it, and it's curious, some of the language, that this bill is driven by parents having choice, which can be translated as meaning people who already have choice will get more choices, that there will be flexibility, see people with choices having more choices, and personalised diverse needs of young people in real time fit for purpose. I absolutely don't think that has any meaning whatsoever. And I don't think that's what the bill's about. And I don't see the point of talking like that to the country, because people want you to talk, and people want the minister and the MPs to talk like human beings. So real purpose, fit for time, personalised what? Whole pathway, is it what, whole of pathway organised efficiency and effectiveness? I mean, sorry, but I think the public deserves some coherence around the education system, and this is not it. This, perhaps she had to make this stuff up because this bill is actually a bit of a messy omnibus, which the Select Committee, and I do respect the members of the Select Committee, but the Select Committee had a big fight, and I think Tracy Martin outlined that very clearly. A couple of things that we disagreed on. One, there was no reason for some of these things that the officials could not answer questions about why some of these things were happening, where the demand was, because a lot of the stuff was just something the government made up for other reasons. And then there was the debacle, the embarrassing debacle of the SOP around Teach First, where the opposition had to fight tooth and nail to make sure that, you know, affected parties like the PPTA, who were heavily involved, not opposing Teach First, but heavily involved, actually got heard.
Joining Catherine Delahunty and the Greens in opposition to the bill were Labor and New Zealand First. Their position explained by their education spokeswoman, Tracy Martin.
Just to be clear, New Zealand First will be opposing the bill. Just to be clear, let's just get that out there. I know it's a shock horror to you, Mr. Speaker, but I thought I'd better put it on the record just in case there was any misunderstanding about where New Zealand First is going here. Now, the Minister mentioned in her contribution that about 40% of the schools here in New Zealand have less than 100 to 150 students. She's right about that. For those very small schools that are 50 to 100, they have what's called teaching principals. So that is where, and these, the schools between 50 to 100 are called U1 to U3 schools. This government has recognised that they've actually had a great deal of difficulty finding principals to take on those positions in those schools, to the point where previously this government has offered an extra $50,000 a year on top of the standard salary of a U1 to U3 principal to encourage principals to go out into U1, U3 schools. In those U1, U3 schools, our most rural of schools, hold some of the most challenging of our behaviours because they are so isolated. What happens when you are a teaching principal in those schools is you do not have the access to the resources inside the urban centres. But instead of actually coming up with a rural solution, as New Zealand First has inside the manifesto, where we would establish an early intervention staffing component for a full-time teaching equivalent for every year one to year three school, so that we can support the students and the principals who are the learning professional leaders of those schools, this government has decided to take principals out of those schools. Out of those schools. And I don't blame the members of the government members of the Education and Science Select Committee. The reality is they are so ignorant about how education actually works that the bovine scatology that Minister Parata can feed them with is accepted by them and just swallowed. And then they stand in this House and try to justify what they don't understand. So they accept this from a minister. So this is the reality of what's happening with regarding to this piece of legislation enabling a principal to manage more than one school. This is because the members of the government believe that the principal is merely a CEO, does not understand what a leading learning professional inside a school does. And I would have thought that Minister Bridges, having sat on the Education and Science Select Committee for a short period of time in the last term and listened to some of the evidence that was provided, would have stood up for the fact that principals are vitally important inside and on the ground in their schools.
Tracy Martin, education spokeswoman for the New Zealand First Party, which joined Labor and the Greens in voting against passing the education legislation bill. Their combined 55 votes defeated by the 63 of National, the Māori Party, ACT and United Future. Finally, Thursday's business statement from the Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee, was followed by this one from Labor's Grant Robertson.
Mr Speaker, I thank the Leader of the House for that, and I'm sure he would want to join me in congratulating his Shadow Leader of the House on the birth of his first child, Charlie Douglas Hipkins, another feisty redhead in the Upper Hutt born yesterday, and we wish Chris and Jade all the very best.
Labour's Grant Robertson, I'm Tom Fruin, and this programme was made with funding from Parliament.